So you had to leave Woodlesford, your family had to leave because of what happened to your dad.
Yeah.
Just tell me your story after that then.
I came up to Swillington School 1938. I was at Swillington School till December 1939. War had broken out, of course. I'd passed a scholarship to go to Whitwood College, which, of course, I went for 2 years. That took me in 1941. I decided, I want to go on the railway, which my father was very much opposed to.
He was opposed because of what had happened to him?
I think it was that, basically because of that. Anyhow, I went for an interview and had an exam, which were the normal things in them days. You had to go for a medical tour to Manchester. That was a bit of a story because the medical for them days for the LMS staff was on what was Victoria Station. And you were given the time, I think it would be there about 9:30 in the morning, Victoria Station, and somebody says, oh, the medical's, it was somewhere in the tower of the city, isn't it, Manchester, only about 1/4 mile away. There was a building, certain building, gave us the address of this building. There were a few asking the same question on the station at Manchester. So we went to this building that wasn't there. It had been blown up overnight, bombed. It was just a smoking coming up out of the road. So we had to all go back to the station and decided they could give us this medical in a carriage with this put in the side in the platform, you know. So we got this medical over and I started in January 1942 at Wellington Street in Leeds, which was the goods depot.
And what did you start as?
As a clerk, a junior clerk. And to say that the work there was horrendous, well, it was wartime. Can you imagine the stuff going out of Leeds in them days, the huge factories making all sorts of things. It was a bit hard going. And, that was 1942. Yeah, I've been there a year doing all sorts of jobs. After about the end of 1942, I was asked to go to the head office in Leeds and they said there's a job going at Woodlesford Station, which they knew where I lived, of course. Was I interested? So I says, well, yes. They said there's one snag, you'll be working a lot longer hours in Woodlesford than you are in Leeds. So I thought, well, I ain't going to be travelling every day to Leeds, but I'll hope for the best, you know. So I took this job at Woodlesford, and what was happening, that there were so many people of my age all being called up. That was the reason somebody at Woodlesford had got called into the army. And I went to Woodlesford, and I was there a year, and I got, well, I can't, I volunteered actually for the Fleet Air Arm when I was 17 and a half, and I didn't tell my mother and father, and they wondered why this letter had come to go for this medical, which they weren't very happy about because I'd not said anything about it. Anyhow, when I told them, they said, you are not going, so forget it. So in the meantime, I'd joined the Air Cadets at Garforth, so I was thinking about going in the RAF, but then they came a bit longer. A bit later on, the RAF said, well, we don't want any air crew. I don't know where I'm going to be. I think I volunteered to be an air gunner, but they said, we don't want any more air gunners, so I decided to go for the Navy. And that was it. I joined the Navy, 43.
What was it like working at Woodlesford then in that year in the war? That was it different to when you were a child?
Absolutely different. When I was there at Woodlesford in 1943, the amount of traffic going from that station as compared with in the 1930s, there was just no comparison. It would become a very, very busy station because everything that we seemed to handle with was all connected with the war. The beer, the trains from Woodlesford, from the brewery, it was all priority traffic because it was all for the troops. And there was this, what I mentioned before, this buffer depot, which was in Rides, right where Rides School is, or somewhere up there. There was all this food coming in to be taken up there, all under quite strict security because it was all ration foods.
I don't know quite what you mean by buffer depot.
Well, that was the name of the place. Now, whether that was a government name for it, I don't know. But it was a huge place. And I know I only ever went up once with one of the lorry drivers and they were very reluctant to let me in because, as I say, this stuff was really priority. As I said, butter and sugar, all stuff that was so vital for people to carry on living, you know.
And it was stored there for...
Stored there for years on end. I don't remember the full facts, but I think round about 1949, 1950, somebody decided to dispose of this stuff. And in what condition it must have been in, I don't know, because it was all refrigerated. I knew the place was all refrigerated. And I think in a lot of cases it was all given away to people, you know, people who are not very well off.
Where did it come from, all the butter and...
Well, a lot of it had come from Canada and America, particularly the butter and the sheet. I suppose the sugar was all local stuff. I suppose we were still growing sugar beet and it was local stuff. But yeah, it was all stuff on ration at the time.
So you mentioned the beer and presumably the water egg was still producing a lot of coal then?
Absolutely, yeah. There was the coal trains going out every day, yeah. Yeah, in fact, I'm going to mention this, that I think it was the winter of 1943. Of course, I'd been at Woodlesford about 2 months then. It was quite a bad winter. And there was a very, very deep snow, which was lasted quite a while. And the coal to burn in the office at the station had run out. And it was so cold, we were virtually in a situation where we could have hardly worked because it was so cold. The station master, Mr. Pierce, had this bright idea, and we didn't really have time because there was so much clerical work to do. He says, I think the best thing you can do is to go onto the lines and walk down towards, like, Methley and pick up what you can find on the lines, what's fallen off the engines, you know. So we both went with these little buckets. And I mean, it was all frozen. The lines were frozen. You know, you couldn't wear gloves because they were wet through with the snow. And we came back. It was like being in Siberia. Anyhow, we managed to do this over 2 or 3 days just to get a bit of stuff to light in the fire. And after a while, I was fed up with this. So when the coal trains were coming out of Water Egg, they were always having to go pretty slow because there were so many trucks on that when they got to the station at Woodlesford, quite off the coal train, but stop, so that you could get a bit more coal on the engine to get cracking again, you know. And they sent this train, stopped this coal train one day, just outside the booking office, and I went out. I said to the driver, is there any chance of a bit of coal? I told him what was going on. Well, typically, the Yorkshire back, and I was as much coal as I want, lad. And he went, told his fireman to go on the tender, and he threw a piece of coal out, which was nearly as big as the station itself. And it was beautiful, shiny stuff. And we carried it into the porter carried it into the booking office, and we had a fire roaring up. And it says, any time, so we looked out for him, and all the time he kept us in coal. There were never any more shortage of coal at the station. I don't know what the station must have thought when he ever said that. So.
The colliery was owned by a company called Briggs at that point. Were all the wagons, did they have Briggs' signs on them?
They did, but a lot of them were all painted out in the wall, you know. They were all painted out. They didn't allow them to have any names, addresses or anything on, so it was Briggs, yeah.
Was there any traffic that was particularly military? I'm thinking of whether tanks or munitions or anything that went through Woodlesford.
Went through every day. Well, in fact, the tanks were all built at Barnbow, which is across the cross gates, and there were these trains going through every day with all the tanks and armoured cars, you name it, all sorts.
But was there anything that actually was unloaded or loaded at Woodlesford?
No, that was all going through, yeah. Of course, I think it was all lining up for D-Day, which, of course, was they knew it was going to happen in 1944, so 43 was the year before, but all the stuff was all kind of building up like the troops.
What about the passengers during 1943 then? Were there more passengers going into Leeds or fewer?
I wouldn't say that there were any more going, no. No, not that I can think of. No, I don't think that was the case. It hadn't varied a lot from, you know... A lot of people worked locally, you see, at Woodlesford. Imagine how many worked at the colliery and how many worked at the brewery. Oh, there were dozens of people that worked locally, yeah.
What else can you remember about 1943?
We all knew, I'd what we called a special train notice, used to come out every week from head office and told us, which were all very strict confidential stuff, what trains were coming through at certain times, which of course a copy went to the signal box and a copy came to us in the office, although the station must have usually had that, but we used to do a bit of a peep and see what was going on. Particularly the troop trains were coming up from Scotland, I presume they must have come off people around Glasgow or Gorick or wherever, they're all disembarking. And there used to be a lot of these troop trains coming through. And it's surprising how many were black troops in them days.
These are Americans?
Americans. And you'd have a train come in with probably 10 to 12 coaches on in them days. And the signal, there was a colour, well, a colour light. Even in them days, it was a colour light signal. But on the line that went off the up line, as we called it, for the colliery, there was a signal there which was basically for that. But, of course, it also controlled the main line. And it worked off some kind of a battery, which was, there was no electrical connection. It was worked off. And he knew when these troop trains were coming, and he'd purposely put it at danger to red when it shouldn't have done, because there was nothing in, you know, in the section before. And he used to tell us when he used to ring, because we had a phone in the office from the box, and so-and-so's coming, and of course we used to nip across the crossing and be on the platform when this train came in, and there'd be all yanks looking out of the, where are we, boy? And what was stuff? Oh, we don't know. And I used to say, well, have you any cigarettes? It was from my father, of course. And yes, oh, yes. And he used to get in the pockets and giving us packets of these Camels and all these other American-type cigarettes. So I used to come home loaded up with cigarettes and get my father in cigarettes, because I don't think he'd have bought any.
And did they throw anything else out?
Oh, I think they liked throwing themselves out. No, it was usually cigarettes. But they were very generous, I must admit. Yeah, and this went on quite a lot. Yeah.
Were there any other accidents and that kind of thing at that time?
1943, I got called up and went to start my initial training at Skegness, and then I went to do my main training in Scotland at Ayr, which was one of the Butlins camps which had all been taken over, you know. And I was on leave, I think it was July 44. It was not long after D-Day, anyhow. And with having worked on the railway, we were still entitled to some kind of free travel, but you had to go and fill a form up, and you had to go to the local booking office or wherever you'd work to get this form to fill up, which is all gone now, of course. And I went into the office at Woodlesford and got this form, just talking in general how I was doing and what all things. And I came out onto the platform coming up to get a bus up home here, and he was there. He was just walking down the line.
Who was, tell me his name?
Free, who you said was Free, because I couldn't remember his name.
Right.
But he was the ganger which, on the rail track, well, still is, I don't think that applies now. On the track, there was the plate layers. They were like the people who did the hard work, and the ganger was always in charge of the plate layers. So he was in charge, and he used to check on what was going on. And he was just more or less coming across the crossing, so he was asking me how I was and all this, and how my father was. Of course, my father was still alive then. And I went to, only talking a few minutes, and I said, oh, my bus is due, so I'll go down. I was down, there was a bus stop still at Bottom Station Lane, well, in Haverford Road. And funnily enough, while I was there, the ambulance went by, which was, where it had come from Rothwell in them days, I don't know, but, and it went up Station Lane, and I never thought any more about it. And it wasn't until I came home on leave, a lot longer than that, in 1946, and I went into the office and they told me what had happened. He got killed that day. Yeah, just only minutes after I'd been talking. And I think it might have been the Devonian. It could have been, because if it was still running though in them days, that was 1944, it used to go through Woodlesford about 11 o'clock, and I think it was about 11 now waiting for the bus.
And what did the people on the station say had happened?
He'd come across the crossing, which is there now, I think, and a train had gone, and he never really looked to see what was coming on the other line. So I don't think he had a chance. He kind of walked into, you know, from like walking behind a bus into something that was going, it was a train express, of course, and that was it.
So even an experienced man worked on the railways all his life.
He'd been on for years on the railway, yeah. He was in his 50s at least, could have been near 60. So that was very sad, yeah.